Good afternoon and welcome aboard. Happy Tuesday to you. John McGinnis with you, News Radio KPK. Lots going on in the news today, as is often the case. It seems like the norm now. Obviously, the thoughts and prayers go out to the folks that are affected by the fires. Devastating series of events that's just destroying a beautiful part of the world, frankly, and taking lives along the way. So we will watch that as time goes on, and perhaps take a closer look at the state of affairs as it relates to the fires in both Northern and Southern California, and what contributing factors may be in play. What, if anything, can be done to mitigate the damage and loss of life in the future? And I think that's a very a tall order, and it's Mother Nature who's in charge. Mother Nature obviously calls the shots on that. Other things going on in the news. This is the time of year when the governor of the state of California has on his desk a stack of bills that have been created by the legislature. And some of those will result in changes, new laws being created. And it's difficult to predict, difficult to understand or try to anticipate where the governor may be going with these bills. One such bill is SB 239. Which was approved by the Democrat-controlled state legislature in September, and it has actually become law. This one the governor has signed it last week. It will cover the charges differently for people who knowingly engage in sexual activities when they are HIV positive, when they have been exposed to HIV and are aware of it. And they have intimate relations with other human beings without first notifying them of their status. It doesn't the law never, by the way, it was a felony until now or in the first of next year. If you engage in that conduct without forewarning your partner that you have that potential, that you do carry the HIV virus. And it was never against the law to engage in intimate relations with someone if you disclose that to them. They could make their choice then as to whether or not that experience was worth the risk. What this does now is make it a misdemeanor. And I'm just a little perplexed by how this is defensible. What it effectively, it was initially targeted at prostitutes because there were cases of people that were known to vice detectives, and this applied in probably virtually every major significant jurisdiction in the state of California where you have frequent flyers, people who have made their living, their lifestyle has been centered on the sex trade. And so they are knowingly affecting other people, risking infecting them as well as affecting them by exposure to the virus that has the potential to become a deadly disease. And there have been changes. There have been improvements in terms of the longevity of a person so afflicted. There's no doubt about it. But think about the state of mind of a person is so inclined and they don't have the decency to forewarn their partner, their would-be partner, of the fact that they have that kind of a risk in their body. And by the way, I think there's probably some reasonable assumption that if a person is affected with HIV, they have probably also been exposed to other diseases, other things that compromise their overall health, and would be inclined to spread that too. I don't think it would be a shocking statistic to learn that people who have been exposed to HIV have probably also been exposed to hepatitis and other sexually transmitted diseases. So if that's the case, is there not a basic fundamental concept of decency that you explain that you forewarn somebody with whom you're about to have intimate relations as to that risk? But for whatever reason, the California legislature and their infinite wisdom, and now the governor has signed on to change this, to reduce the penalty associated with that. This statute now revises the old law that dates back to the 1980s when AIDS had emerged as a public health crisis, especially in cities such as San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. And fear and misinformation about the disease's potential to spread ran high. That's their position on it, as the authorities struggled to get a handle on the new epidemic and a spate of legislation about HIV exposure cropped up across the country. Well, there was fear. There was fear because the future, the longevity of a person so afflicted or so exposed, I should say, was not good. It was a curse. It was a death sentence. And again, with the advancements in medicine and science to overcome that and perhaps extend the lives of people so exposed, I understand how it's not quite as clear an outcome as it was back then. Nonetheless, it still seems like a common decency, if nothing else. So in the current the change that becomes effective the first part of next year, to engage in intimate relations with someone without forewarning them is now simply a misdemeanor, for which, and realistically, in California, there's no jail time. Does that make sense? Is that what you think is a good idea? Supporters of the reform push it in California because of what they describe as misinformation. The supporters include a broad coalition of public health, LGBT, civil liberties, and HIV groups in the state. And they describe the laws as outdated and ineffective, pointing to statistics that show that the vast majority of convictions were related to sex workers, prostitutes, who are required to undergo testing for HIV after being convicted of crimes such as solicitation. I think that still makes sense. If, people who have a bug, a minor bug of some kind, will oftentimes engage in an act of kind of common decency, I think, and warn people around them, don't get too close, be advised that I do have this this bug that you don't want to get. And in fact, there's a new, I think, general politeness protocol in terms of how people cover their mouths when they sneeze. They no longer use the hand and then pass that along and transfer whatever germs or bug they may be carrying. Now you see the polite protocol is you sneeze into your elbow and hope that people aren't exposed to that. But the idea is decent people undertake basic efforts to minimize that risk. Now you have something that still has the potential to be deadly, nowhere near as bad as it was when the epidemic was first identified, but still a problem. So why in the world is the legislature and the governor functioning in this direction? Do you believe that there is a good, legitimate purpose behind that? I think it's a very, very legitimate question. And by the way, as we work our way through the program today, we have another one that has, this has been approved by the legislature. And it's actually on the governor's desk now. This would be SB 394, which will assure that if the governor signs it into law, and it's very, very difficult to predict what he may do, but this is going to strike him close to home because it this is represented by an incident that took place in his unofficial home county of Colusa. The change in the law would call for an opportunity for consideration for release for those people who were tried and convicted of violent crimes, tried as adults, notwithstanding they had not yet hit their 18th year of life, so they're minors at the time, but the crime was so horrific and so violent that they were tried as an adult, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison or 25 to life. They will now have an opportunity to have that sentence effectively reversed and have them released from custody early. We are going to talk to a surviving sibling, a sister, of a young man who was murdered in Colusa County back in 1997, and get a little bit of a feeling from the family perspective, those people who have been so dramatically affected by this experience. So it's not just a matter of statistics, not just charts and numbers and figures and another notch on a homicide statistical chart, but rather a true person, a family devastated, a community devastated, and a young life lost. And in this particular case, some of the callous, cold-hearted, incredibly mean, cruel, vicious conduct that was involved. So we'll get to all that as we work our way through the program. But my question for you now is, what do you think about the idea of reducing the consequences for people who engage in sexual activity with human partners without warning them that they are HIV positive, when they know that to be the case? They've got the diagnosis, they've got the record, they know. And again, this does not call for a prohibition on them having intimate relations with others. It simply calls for them to disclose it to their prospective partners in advance of. It has been a felony. Now it's going to be reduced to a misdemeanor, passed by the legislature, signed into law by the governor. How do you feel about that? 916-921-1530, 800-834-1530. More conversation coming up after this. Don't go away.
The news that affects you and your family every day. News Radio KFBK.
Hey, John McGinnis on News Radio KFBK. You can help our families and friends that have been impacted by the wildfires. Make a donation to the Red Cross by dialing #250 from your smartphone and say the keyword fire relief. We'll have an option of receiving a text reply. By the way, I got to apologize for my voice. It's cutting in and out. I think it's the smoke in the air, but I feel fine if you care. I do feel fine. And we're talking about a couple of things. And by the way, maybe it's appropriate to note, I don't think I have anything infectious if you have close contact with me. You're okay by radio, though. But we're talking about the concept of reducing the consequences for people who knowingly engage in intimate sexual activities with other human beings when they know that they are HIV positive. That has been a felony for the past couple of decades. Now the governor has signed into law this legislation that will make it a misdemeanor, reduce the consequences after the first of the year. Does that make any sense to you? Is there any wisdom in that? Is it somehow gotten more appropriate? Understanding that to be fair and objective, the medical science has advanced to the extent that it's not the death sentence it once was, or at least that what it was once perceived to be. Let's get your call, shall we? 916-921-1530, 800-834-1530. Let's check in with Robert in Rockland. Robert, good afternoon, sir. Welcome to the conversation.
Hello, sir. How are you today?
Terrific. Thanks.
Well, you know, to me, this is just another absurdity in our liberal life here in this California. Instead of using the excuse of, well, these other things that
people... Oh, I think we lost a part of that. Yeah.
So I guess my point is that instead of we have these other things that people can pass on to people that they consider misdemeanors, they use that as an excuse.
Yeah.
To decriminalize the HIV, when if you think about it and you're logical about it, the other things should be just as criminalized as HIV because they affect people's lives in such a way that it ruins them.
Absolutely true. And by the way, just to make it clear, it's not decriminalizing, it's just reducing the consequences from a felony to a misdemeanor. So theoretically, a felony calls for a state prison term, a misdemeanor does not. In practice, in reality, state prison terms are pretty hard to get these days. And nobody, I can assure you, nobody will go to jail for doing any time in custody for this once it becomes a misdemeanor. And again, it's just the idea. It does not deny or the privilege or access to intimacy between people. It simply says if you're going to do so, you need to disclose if you have this disease. So point well taken, Robert. I appreciate the call very much. Let's check in with Lewis and Isaac. Lewis, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation, sir. What do you think?
Well, you know, John, this is really illogical. I when you introduced the topic, I was waiting for you to kind of shine the light on the reason behind it. But, you know, when the governor has a position, when he has the opportunity to weigh either on the side of safety or maybe a harmful outcome, it seems to me a person in his position is always to go to the side of safety.
One would think.
And, one would think, obviously, the last few years, the things that he's done has proven that wrong.
Yeah,
but I'm really at a loss for words. I don't, other than making a very small number of people feel as if what they may have now isn't an issue for the rest of us who don't have it. I mean, I'm not going to ever use those services and contract this disease. But
the argument is, part of the justification is people are stigmatized by virtue of having this disease. And of course, let's be honest, it could throw a kind of a pall over romantic experience when you say, oh, by the way, this is going in a really nice direction, but I feel obligated to tell you that I have HIV. Okay. All right. Let's rethink this maybe and think about a different time at a different place with other considerations in play. No, I think your observations are valid, and I cannot for the life of me understand why there would be a desire to reduce the sanctions for putting somebody at risk. It's just a rotten thing to do to somebody. Let them make their decision fully informed. If they're willing to take the risk, so be it.
But, John, being stigmatized, that's there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Through history, that's developed to kind of say, hey, caution here. There's something wrong. Not necessarily that you're a bad person or horrible person, but that you know that you have something or you've done something the rest of the public needs to be aware of.
Of course.
Mean,
well,
you know, a criminal, a heroin addict, you know, people who routinely break the law. Yeah, they're stigmatized.
Well, maybe by virtue of a blood transfusion. I mean, that's a possibility. So I think in terms of passing judgment on people who are HIV positive, I can understand an effort to avoid that, but to be fully aware of the risk that to which you may be exposed should you choose to engage in intimacy. I think that's a good thing. That's positive. But hey, Lewis, I appreciate the call very much, sir. Let's see if we can squeeze Anthony and Rockland in. Anthony, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation.
Oh, thank you. The one thing about it, I think HIV was considered an epidemic at one time, or they use that word, and with these new ideas and that making it a felony, it's under control now. Why stir that up? Why change it?
Yeah, good point. That felony prohibition may very well have led to a reduction in the spread. I don't know if there's data to support that. By the way, I got a call from somebody who's offended by my suggestion that somebody who's been exposed to HIV would probably have a greater risk of being exposed to other STDs and other diseases for that matter. And I'm sorry if that offends you, but I stand by it. My sense is, and I could be wrong, I'd be open to being proven wrong, but my sense is the extent to which you engage in high-risk activity and get exposed to diseases would probably spread across the entire spectrum of disease. And why expose people to the consequences
right.
unnecessarily?
It seems to be working. We've got it more under control. I don't understand why they want to change that. But
It's California, sir. I appreciate the call, Anthony, very much. We got to take care of some business real quickly. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a compelling story. You're going to hear the heart-wrenching details of a life lost, a cruel and egregious crime committed against a young man whose sister is going to be with us after we take care of some other business here very shortly. And then this piece of legislation now on the governor's desk that would change the law with regard to keeping the people responsible for this kind of a crime in custody for life. Do you want to see that happen? The conversation coming up after this. Don't go away.
Join us this afternoon at 4 for the latest on the Northern California wildfires. The afternoon news 4 to 7 today on News Radio KFBK.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying on board. John DeGuinness with you, News Radio KFBK. Talking about other items of legislative interest, a bill that's on the governor's desk. This would be Senate Bill 394. And it's a complex issue, but it has to do with people who try these people as adults. They cannot be sentenced to death. They're not eligible for that. But they have been subject to sentencing to life in prison without possibility of parole. This bill provides that a person who was convicted of a controlling offense, that is to say a violent and atrocious murder in this case, that was committed before the defendant had reached 18 years of age and for which the sentence is life without the possibility of parole, shall be eligible for release on parole by a parole hearing board, during his or her 25th year of incarceration at a youth offender parole hearing. Which is interesting unto itself. You don't think of them as a youth offender. You think of them as a convict, a criminal, who has committed a violent and atrocious crime. Now, I'm very happy and honored to have in studio someone who has no desire to be thrust into this conversation, but because of the actions of others, finds herself where she's personally affected by it. Devin Lombardi. Welcome, Devin. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And I'm very, very pleased that you're willing to do this and explain your story. You lost your brother back in 1997 to a violent crime in which a young adult, age 18, not a juvenile at the age of 16, were convicted of his murder. Violent, horrible murder. Tell us a little bit about your brother, Eric, and who he was and what happened here.
Yeah, so... at the age of 16, my brother had just got his license and he'd been working to get his first car, which we called Old Blue. And he was very social, always wanted to be around friends, very funny, a bit of a smart aleck, but that's also something that people appreciated about
sure.
him.
I can relate.
Just very outgoing, very kind at his core. very into sports. Basketball was his number one passion above everything else.
And growing up in beautiful Colusa County, in Colusa?
Yeah.
Kind of like a Mayberry?
Tight-knit community. Yeah. Everyone knows everyone, and everyone knows everyone's business. And Eric was certainly one of the kids who wanted to be known and seen by everyone.
Athlete?
Yes.
Had plans, had college aspirations?
Last I can remember, he had hoop dreams, probably wanted to be in the NBA, but he certainly wanted to attend UCLA. Basketball was, like I said, the biggest part of his life, and it's something that him and my father shared. My dad was our coach growing up, and he played. I mean, these kids played with each other since, you know, third grade and up. They, you know, played basketball.
So well known in a small town.
Yes,
really, truly, very much a Mayberry kind of community. Colusa is.
Yes, it is.
And the place where you don't typically worry a lot about crime and violence. It's not that kind of a place.
You don't. It's the type of place where before this happened to my brother, you don't lock your cars, you don't lock your front doors. Kids play in the streets. Kids walk around the neighborhood. There's no need to be afraid of this type of stuff.
And your brother had a relationship with, knew the two people who have ultimately been arrested, tried, and convicted of this crime?
Well, I mean, to say he knew them is an understatement. So they were considered his best friends. I mean, if you were to ask him at that time, they were a couple of them. He had many best friends, but they were certainly on the list.
And it was, as I understand it, kind of a setup where they kind of indicated to him there was a social outing or an evening of fun planned. And these two convicts, people convicted of this crime, they're not youthful offenders, by the way, they're killers. And that's not a reckless allegation. They have been, through due process of law, tried and convicted of the crime of murder.
Yes.
Each of them. Mm-hmm. So they're killers.
Yes.
And understand one was 16 years of age and the other 18. And the irony, as I understand it, is that the 16-year-old was more the leader of the group. Is that your read?
That is my understanding from my conversations with the district attorney, as well as my conversations with Leo himself.
And so what did they do? How do they go about the commission of this crime?
Well, I understand it. Eric, it was a typical night. July 15th, Eric was at work.
Where did he work?
He worked at our local grocery store.
Okay.
Holiday Market.
All-American kid, working at the Holiday Market, going to school, playing basketball.
Yeah, that's
Buying a blue truck or car.
Yeah, Old Blue.
Okay.
Yeah, Old Blue was his baby, and he had just gotten off of work, took off his apron, his, at the time, beeper, because that's what was then.
1997,
in. Yeah. Yeah, and Nathan and Leo roll up and tell Eric that they have something to show him. Something's going on. They take a drive out to the river. And when Eric gets out of the car, Nathan carries out his planned attack.
And we'll get into the details as we work our way through. But what was the, Nathan is the younger of the two. He's 16 years of age. Is it Leo?
Leo.
He's 18. So he's legally an adult.
Yes.
None of this would apply to Leo.
Yes.
But what was the issue? What was the grudge or the bone to pick with Eric?
I've been told that Eric and Nathan, although I didn't know it at the time, Eric and Nathan, might have had a little bit of a beef going on, a fight between friends. Certainly nothing, a fight that I might have with a friend.
Sure.
You get in disagreements. I think, you know, according to several people, including the district attorney, Eric was on his way out of that friendship.
Eric's your brother.
Eric, my brother, was on his way out of that friendship and was getting to a point in his life with Nathan that he was maybe starting to see what everyone else had been warning him about and telling him about. And so, with Leo being in the car, Eric felt okay to get in.
And they took them out to a place, a remote location on the river. Was this, did they hang out at the river? Was this a place they may be inclined to go?
In a small town, it is very common to throw parties out by the river or in the rice fields or in the barn. There was certainly nothing stopping him from thinking, oh, this doesn't feel right.
And let's talk about the two convicted criminals in this case. Prior to that, did they seem to be normal kids in the community? Were they part of the fabric of of Colusa?
So they were a part of the community. They both had jobs, like Eric, local jobs. They were frequently in and out of my home on a daily basis. That day, July 15th, Leo and Eric had dropped me off themselves that day. And my last conversation with both of them, the last time I saw them both, they were together. I asked them to help convince my mom to let me go to a party that my friend Margot Topman had been throwing. And I said, please, Leo, talk to my mom. You know, what I'm trying to get here is they were part of our family. They were
in and out of your house.
They were in and out
welcome
of
our,
my house.
And just again, to clarify for the audience, Leo is the adult that was convicted of this. Mm-hmm. Eric's your brother. The other convicted criminal,
yes.
Juvenile at the time,
yes.
He was the adult.
Nathan was 16.
Okay.
He was the juvenile. Leo was 18.
And Nathan was not there for that last conversation.
He was not there for that. Nope.
Okay.
That was Eric and Leo and I.
Okay. So we got to take care of some other business here, but I want to ask you to give us the unfortunate details of this, exactly how it went, because I want the audience to understand that these are not just simply statistics, one more log on the homicide data bank, but rather true people, personalities, character, victims, lives that have been affected by it, the impact that it's had on your family, the impact that it's had on the community, and now the contemplation of the thought that the governor has to decide will there be an opportunity to send this to this parole board hearing, effectively, which is, we'll see how it works out if it's signed into law, but I don't have a lot of hope for it. Much of the changes in recent years, it's become very pro forma, where documents, papers are reviewed. There's not even a true hearing, and release from institutions is happening. So much more conversation on this after we take care of some other business. Thank you so very much for being here with us, and we shall return right after this.
The local news you care about most. More reporters on the scene covering more stories. News Radio KFBK.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying on board. John McGinnis with you. Very, very weighty topic today. This is not for the faint of heart, but it's reality. It's what people need to know as you look at these laws that are being passed by the legislature, signed into law by the governor. I don't know what the governor will do with this yet. And in the spirit of full disclosure, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case that came out, Miller versus Alabama, that does call for trial and sentencing courts to consider the underdeveloped or undeveloped juvenile mind when it comes to sentencing. That's one thing. There's an opportunity for that, and there's even an opportunity for the original sentencing court to reconsider. But this is different. This is different than that. This calls for another body, gubernatorial appointees who represent the philosophy of the governor, to be able to make a decision as to whether or not these people should be released. I want to get into the hard elements of this, and of course we've got Devin Lombardi, who is the sister to Eric, and you had to be about 13, 14 years of age at the time. 13, and you lost your big brother.
Yes.
And you had to learn of the horrific nature in which his life was taken. And I hate this conversation. I absolutely hate it. I don't like to do this. But if people are going to be affected by these laws, and people in the horseshoe at the governor's office listen to this program, they're aware of what the thoughts of the public are, let's let the public know exactly what it is they're contemplating and who they may be inclined to release early. And therefore, if you can do it, if you can grit it and tell us exactly what took place, what these young guys did to your brother.
Yeah, so I know that when he stepped out of the vehicle, he was distracted. And I know that Nathan took the baseball bat to his head. I know that he fell and they continued to beat him. And I know that Nathan then used a butcher knife that he had stolen, and he took that to Eric's body.
I understand his throat was slashed also. And did you ever get an account for in terms of his reaction when this first started? Because it was not an instantaneous death.
It wasn't.
He had to suffer this at the hands of his friends.
Yeah. Yes. It was confirmed to me that this was not over fast. And there was a moment when his eyes opened and he realized what was happening.
Realized what these two people that he considered friends were doing to him.
Yes.
And now the ringleader here, the guy who was calling the shots, 16 years of age at the time, but a cold-hearted, calculated killer, who also persuaded and convinced his accomplice to engage in this kind of behavior.
Yes.
Is now going to be in a position where he'll be subject to early release in another 5 or so years if this becomes law.
That's correct.
Do you want this guy, do you want these two guys ever to walk the streets of Colusa County again or anywhere?
It's not just me. The entire town is petrified at the thought of Nathan Ramazzini being allowed in this world again. He is dangerous, and the thought is petrifying.
Nathan Ramazzini is the juvenile who was convicted, tried as an adult, and convicted of this crime, being the ringleader of it, causing Leo to behave in this fashion. Which, again, that doesn't defend Leo in any way, shape, manner, or form. It wasn't as though he convinced him to commit a minor vandalism. This was the most egregious of all crimes.
Right.
And to knowing the family, knowing the people to be adversely impacted by this, I don't see that changing ever.
Well,
so for the system upon which we all rely, we're forced to rely because we have no options. The system we call justice, to allow this to happen is reprehensible. So I appreciate you being here very much. I know it's tough for you. We're going to stay in touch with you on this, though. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you letting me get the word out about this and spread awareness.
Absolutely. Thank you for your courage and strength. And I'm sorry you had to tell the story, but it had to be told.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. That's it for me, as you can tell by the sound of music. But stick around. You got Mike Haggerty coming up next with the afternoon news. We'll see you tomorrow.